One of the United States' most infamous serial killers wasn't even born there. And it's suspected that she murdered between 14 people and a figure in the 40s. And as Annette tightened, her body was found dead and headless. But was it her body? In today's episode, we'll look at the infamous case of Belle Guinness. Hi, and welcome back to the Historical Crimes and Criminals podcast. I'm Steve, your host. And it's big thanks to Kat and Kat's True Crime Corner for today's episode. Brynhild Palsdatter Storseth was born on November the 11th, 1859, in Selbu, Norway. She was the youngest of eight children, born to a family of farmhands who worked for a more affluent family. Brynhild grew up farming and knew very well how to run a successful steady farm, and she was very accustomed to the tough physical labour from a young age. But by the age of 14, Brynhild began saving in order to earn enough passage money to New York. Like many Europeans, she was sold on the American dream. And in 1881, she used what savings she had and begged her brother-in-law for the rest in order to make her way to the United States. When she passed through the immigration process, she changed her name from Brynhild to Belle, wanting a more American-sounding name for her new life. She travelled on to Chicago, where she joined her sister Nellie, who had emigrated to the United States a few years prior. Whilst Belle was with her sister and brother-in-law, she earned her keep, first as a domestic servant, and then in a butcher's shop, picking up skills that would become useful to her throughout her life. In 1884, Belle was running some errands where she entered a department store, and there she met Mads Sorensen, a fellow Norwegian immigrant. Belle was charmed by the man and found him incredibly handsome. It was love at first sight. Soon the couple began courting and were married in 1884, the year they met. Belle was desperate to have children, but the couples had problem conceiving. Instead, Mads suggested they adopt. And agreeing to this, Belle and Mads fostered two children, who Mads absolutely adored. The couple were living their American dream. They had a modest home and owned a small business, a candy store. In quick succession, both the store and their home burned down. Belle was very quick to collect the insurance payouts for both incidents, and despite friends and neighbours gossiping about the coincidence of the incidents, the Sorensens went about their own business, until tragedy struck. In 1886 and then 1888, two of Sorensen's foster children died. Officially, the cause of death was listed as colitis. Despite the tragedy, Belle had insured the children's lives and was able to collect the insurance payouts following both deaths. Following the tragedy, the Sorensens adopted three more children, all girls, Myrtle, Lucy, and Jenny, and Belle wasn't taking any risks. Feeling pressured by his wife, as well as the tragedy of losing two children, Mads purchased two life insurance policies for himself, naming his wife as the beneficiary. On July the 30th, 1890, the policies overlapped each other. It was the only day that both policies would be active at the exact same time. And the same day, Mads Sorensen died of a cerebral hemorrhage. When Belle called for the doctor, she explained that Mads had been complaining of a headache upon returning home. Tending to her husband, she gave him some quinine powder to manage the pain. But when she checked up on him a little later, she found him dead. No one contradicted this story, and Belle collected the life insurance from both policies. This totaled $8,000. And using the money, Belle packed up her children and moved to La Porte, Indiana. There, she bought a pig farm, and what she felt like was a fresh start. On April the 1st, 1902, Belle married Peter Gunnis, also a Norwegian immigrant. Peter was also a widow. His wife had passed away, and he found it difficult to raise his young children on his own. Marion Belle, a sturdy, good-looking woman of means who owned her own property, would offer his children a mother's tending loving care, and Peter thought this was a dream come true. A week after the wedding, while Peter was away from the home, his infant daughter passed away. No official cause of death was noted, and no real suspicions arose from the death of the child. Shortly thereafter, Belle discovered that she was pregnant. Following the news, the Gunnis marriage soured. Belle began to see her husband in a very different light, especially after the birth of her son. Belle planned it all very, very carefully, thinking it through and weighing the pros and the cons. A few months after they said their vows, on a cold December evening in 1902, Belle prepared dinner for her family. And she also prepared a special drink for Peter. She put the drink off to the side and fed her family. When the children were safely tucked up in bed, Belle handed Peter the drink and watched as the strychnine slowly took hold of him. When Peter fell unconscious, she took up a meat cleaver and smashed it into his skull, killing him. And then she staged the scene. Belle placed Peter on the kitchen floor, made it appear as though his head had been crushed by a fallen meat grinder which had been on a high shelf. Satisfied, Belle called for the doctor. The coroner found the death highly suspicious and called for a coroner's jury in order to perform an investigation. The jury, however, found nothing suspicious about Peter's death, and despite some gossip and lingering concern surrounding Belle, the matter was dropped. Belle then collected on Peter's life insurance policy, earning $3,000 for her dead husband's life. Belle's jig was nearly up when her foster daughter Jenny allegedly told her classmates that her mama killed my papa. She told them she hit him with a meat cleaver and he died. Don't tell a soul. As Jenny was preparing for college at this time, Belle took advantage of the opportunity. She told Jenny's friends she decided to go to a college in California, and no one ever heard of Jenny again. For a few years, Gunnis went around her business, tending to her farm, offering hiring farmhands to help her with the chores around the property. It's also helped that the farmhands paid her a lot of attention. Attention that she relished in. Soon tongues began wagging around La Porte for a different reason. Gunnis was going through farmhands so fast, there were few in the community left who hadn't worked in her farm or worked her over behind closed doors. But seemingly this attention wasn't enough. Tending the farm required finances, and Gunnis needed financial security. She began placing marriage ads in Norwegian language newspapers in 1905. The ads read, "Personal, comely widow who owns a large farm in one of the finest districts in La Porte County, Indiana, desires to make an acquaintance of a gentleman equally well provided, with view of joining fortunes. No replies by letter considered unless sender is willing to follow answer with personal visit. Triflers need not apply. Between 1905 and 1907, dozens of men replied to her ads. One such suitor was Henry Gerholt, who travelled to La Porte from Wisconsin. Upon his arrival on the Gunness farm, Henry wrote to his family that he was in good health, but requesting that they send him seed potatoes for the farm. But Henry was never heard of again. His family contacted Gunness, though the two had never married. They knew that Henry had intended on it and had provided his finances to Gunness in order to secure the marriage. She informed the Gerharts that Henry had left her to go to Chicago with horse traders. In 1906, John Moe of Minnesota corresponded with Gunness for several months before he packed up, withdrew a large sum of money, and travelled to La Porte, Indiana. And like some kind of horror film, John was never heard of again. And the pattern continued with Olag Svenherod, Olag B. Birdsburg, and Olag Lindblom, to name a few. George Anderson had also answered Gunness' ad. He arrived in La Porte from Missouri, hoping for love and a steady farm to tend. And this is not what he found. One night, while he was sleeping in a separate bedroom from Gunness, George woke up to find her looming over her in his sleep. He was startled and noted her eyes looked ravenous and cold. Frightened, George packed what he could and left the farm that night. He was the only male suitor to survive the conniving clutches of Belle Gunness. With her options for suitors running low, Gunness hired Ray Lamphere as her new farmhand in 1907. The man was known around the community for being unsavoury, lending himself to drink and gambling, but Gunness saw potential in him, and he worked diligently for her. Lamphere grew fond of Gunness very quickly. He felt lucky to be given a room in her home on the second floor, and even luckier when Gunness would share his bed. Gunness enjoyed his attention, but she still saw other suitors. And when these men would come and go, Lamphere expressed severe jealousy and often possessiveness over Gunness. He hated when her attention was on other men she was conning rather than himself. After an intense argument over his jealousy in 1908, Gunness fired Lamphere and kicked him off the property. Gunness hired another farmhand immediately, Joe Maxton. Whilst he was more competent and more than willing to work hard, Gunness was disgruntled. Joe did not seem to care about her at all. But that was fine. Gunness had her hands full with her jilted lover. After being terminated from his position, Lamphere, according to sources, became an endless source of grief. Gunness was troubled that Lamphere was prowling around her property, peeking in windows and trying to get her attention. He wrote to the sheriff, Albert Schmutzer, repeatedly about Lamphere's behaviour. When it seemed that Lamphere's behaviour would not stop, she tried to have him declared insane. And when this tactic failed, she had him arrested in March of 1908. He was fined for trespassing. But a few days later, Lamphere was arrested again, although released more or less immediately. This time, the community was on the lookout for Lamphere and was aware of his fixation on the widowed Belle Gunness. On April the 27th, 1908, Belle Gunness visited her attorney, Melvin E. Leitler. To him, Gunness appeared anxious, maybe nervous. He couldn't blame her, what with Lamphere business occurring around her. When she asked him to help her draw up a will, he didn't think anything of it. His client was protecting herself, just in case. And Melvin was more than happy to assist Gunness in any way he could. Following the meeting, Gunness did a bit of shopping. She wandered around town, bought some cakes and a toy train for her young son, and she also bought 2 cans of kerosene. The following morning, the Gunness farm was found burnt to the ground. Ray Lamphere was immediately arrested for arson. And as investigators were looking around the scene, they found 4 bodies. 3 were Bell Gunness's children, and the 4th was a body of a headless woman. Everyone assumed the body belonged to Bell Gunness herself, murdered alongside her 3 children. However, when further investigation of the property uncovered at least 11 additional bodies, investigators began to ask questions they hadn't considered before. Initially, investigators believed Bell to be an innocent victim, as they were investigating the crime scene, but LaPorte authorities were then contacted by Iles Kilgillen. Iles had found correspondence between his brother Andrew and Bell Gunness back home in South Dakota. The letters from Gunness urged Andrew to move to LaPorte secretly and to bring with him a large sum of money. When the family never heard from Andrew again, they grew concerned, and Gunness was less than forthcoming as to his whereabouts. When they heard about the discovery, Iles made haste to LaPorte. He needed to see the scene for himself. When he arrived, aided to the location with one of Gunness's fired farmhands, they noticed soft depressions around the pig pens. When investigators dug these depressions, they uncovered a bag. The bag contained 2 hands, 2 feet, and 1 head. And Iles identified the body parts as his brother Andrew. Dozens of these depressions were further discovered, and more body parts were uncovered. All the body parts appeared to have been expertly butchered. Each body had been decapitated, arms removed at the shoulders, and the legs removed at the knees. They were then placed in burlap sacks and buried near the pig pens. The more investigators dug, the more they found. At one point, they stopped counting how many bodies had been buried on the Gunness property. They were especially heartbroken, although not surprised, when they positively identified the body of Gunness's foster daughter, Jenny. News media has latched onto the story, and it became a national sensation. Newspapers labelled Bell Gunness by different names: Black Widow, Hell's Bell, Indiana Ogress, and the Mistress of the Castle of Death. The coverage prompted the families of the men who corresponded with Gunness to try and have their missing loved ones identified. Identification was not possible in most cases, and as many as 40 victims were estimated to have been killed and buried on the property. But a few questions remained. Was the headless woman really Bell Gunness? Had she been murdered? Had Ray LaFaire done it? On May the 19th, 1908, a couple of dental bridges were found near the Gunness home. A local dentist identified these as belonging to Bell Gunness, thus convincing many people that the headless woman was indeed her. But not were all convinced, and the discovery of the dental bridges was just not simply enough for positive identification. It appeared as though Bell Gunness, assisted by Ray Lamphere, had cut her losses, taken all the cash she'd stolen from the suitors, faked her death, and fled the crime scene. Meanwhile, Ray Lamphere was in police custody for arson and murder. The prosecution acknowledged that it was difficult to hold someone responsible for Gunness's death, if, in fact, the body was hers. With murder off the table, they still pursued charges of arson. Prosecutors were certain that Lamphere was aware of what Gunness had been up to on her farm, although he denied this vehemently. He had no idea. If he had, he would have turned her in himself, lest he became another one of her unwitting victims. Lamphere continued to plead his innocence. His reputation, though not great to begin with, was further tarnished by Guinness's campaign around town, slandering his name. But the prosecution had enough to suggest that, although he might not have committed the murders, he had more than enough motive to burn down his ex-lover's farm. And the jury agreed. They believed that he'd started the fire. An autopsy on the children showed that they had not died in the fire. Traces of strychnine had been found in their systems, indicating that Guinness had poisoned them prior to the fire being set. Ray Lamphere was then acquitted of the charges of murder, but he was convicted on charges of arson in November of 1908. And just a year after his conviction, Ray Lamphere died in prison of TB. Lamphere confessed to Reverend Edwin Schnell on his deathbed that he knew that Guinness was placing ads seeking husbands only to murder the suitors that arrived and taking sums of money. He also confessed that Guinness had tasked him with burning the farm down. Furthermore, Lamphere confessed that the headless body had indeed been a ruse to mislead investigators in believing that Guinness herself had been murdered. He asserted that she'd fled to avoid prosecution for her misdeeds. She'd been spurred on by Iles Helgeline, insistence that he visit the property and see if his brother was there for himself. A journalist, Edward Betchley, desperately wanted this confession, and the Reverend and his wife declined to allow Edward to publish the account. However, another newspaper scooped the story and published the account, and following this, the Reverend allowed Edward to publish it in his own newspaper. And the mystery of whatever happened to Belle Guinness remains just that. Many sightings of her have been reported over the years, but none could positively be identified being Belle Guinness. The doctor who performed the post-mortem on the headless body testified that it would have been approximately 5 inches shorter and approximately 50 pounds lighter than Belle. And this, despite Belle being declared dead, police continued to follow up sightings over the following decades. A very curious paradox for sure. Following the media frenzy around the discovery of the crimes, the Guinness farm became a tourist attraction. And to this day, the LaPorte County Historical Society Museum have maintained a permanent exhibit surrounding the infamous Belle Guinness. And then, in 1931, a woman by the name of Esther Carlson, who had an uncanny resemblance to Belle, was arrested in Los Angeles. And the coincidences continued. She'd been arrested for poisoning a Norwegian-American man, and then stealing his money. Whilst awaiting trial, the woman died of TB. Carlson was about the same age that Belle would have been in 1931. And there was, coincidentally, no records of Carlson before 1908, the year Belle's headless corpse had been found. In 2008, DNA tests were done to compare the headless body against a sample from a letter Guinness had sent to a victim. Unfortunately, due to its age, the sample was not able to be tested properly. And thus, the mystery remained. Well, that's it for another episode of the Historical Crimes and Criminals podcast. I hope you enjoyed that one. And thanks again to Kat. You'll find the links to her blog on today's show notes. And until next time, bye-bye.